May it please the Court, Lawrence Rolfing on behalf of Martin Rincon. This case involves three discrete questions about the treatment of Mr. Rincon's application for disability benefits. The first one turns on the residual functional capacity assessment for the physical requirements of work. Dr. Ross, the treating physician, stated that Mr. Rincon could stand and walk for 1 hour a day, needed a cane, could not stoop. Dr. Petrigliano stated that Mr. Rincon could stand and walk for 2 hours a day, could engage in no stooping and other activities because of his need for a cane. The ALJ found that Mr. Rincon could, in fact, stand and walk for 2 hours a day and stated that the treating physician's opinion was not supported by the longitudinal record. Well, the regulations tell us that a limitation to standing and walking 2 hours a day is a pretty significant limitation. You've got to have a lot going on and a lot of objective evidence to erode the ability to stand and walk down to 2 hours a day. And to find a knife that will cut between the difference between 1 hour and 2 hour, saying that it's not supported by the longitudinal record, these are contextual reasons. Specific and legitimate reasons supported by substantial evidence is contextual, and it flexes from case to case and fact pattern to fact pattern.
So, okay, so that's the case, but the vocational expert only focused on sedentary work, and that's what she found.
Correct.
So in a way, although the point can be made, as you have, in fact, the sedentary work that she said existed was such that if he was sitting, he wouldn't be standing, he wouldn't be stooping, so your issue would not really be relevant.
The commissioner has construed the administrative notice provisions of 404-1566-D and 416-966-D to find that the vocational expert can deviate from the Dictionary of Occupational Titles, and in this case, the vocational expert is consistent with the DOT. But the end of that ruling says that the vocational expert can do whatever he or she wants to, but the ALJ cannot accept testimony from a vocational expert that is inconsistent with agency policy. In the broad range of 137 unskilled sedentary jobs, only 6 of them are rated in the DOT as requiring any significant stooping. Yet the commissioner in 96.9P tells us that a complete inability to stoop will significantly erode the unskilled sedentary occupational base and ordinarily result in the finding of disability. The vocational expert has to explain herself when she deviates from the DOT. The commissioner doesn't. The commissioner takes administrative notice of her experience in adjudicating 2.8 million claims per year. And when the commissioner tells the general public, the people that are claiming benefits, that the complete inability to stoop is going to have such a significant erosive impact on the ability to engage in sedentary work, and a vocational expert
tells... So are you saying that the administrative law judge should have just rejected all of that based upon that ruling? And in this case, I don't believe, as I recall, that Mr. Rincon's lawyer made an objection or found that objected to the qualifications of the expert in any way.
That would be me.
Oh, that would be you. Okay. I don't recall that. Did you? Did you ask to have the witness excluded because she could not make give opinion testimony?
There's a difference between, Your Honor, with all due respect, there's a difference between objecting to someone's qualifications to testify and arguing that their testimony isn't substantial evidence. And this vocational expert has the bulk provider agreement from the agency. The region assigns and qualifies vocational experts. She testifies before ALJs on a regular and frequent basis. She has the CRC and the vocational rehabilitation credentials to be an expert, to know about work. But that doesn't mean that her testimony is always going to be consistent with agency policy.
Is that the argument you made below to the ALJ? Did you say to the ALJ, no matter what she says, it's irrelevant because of this policy that exists?
I argued that the...
I mean, did you offer that at the time, or are you... That's just
I believe I argued that the ruling is contrary, that 96.9P states that the inability to stoop does erode the vocational base, and I believe I cross-examined the vocational expert on that specific issue.
But erode is a matter of law. So if that were was the case, that presentation should have been made to the ALJ, and the testimony should have been excluded because it would be irrelevant.
Well, whether or not testimony is substantial evidence is a question of law, and the Appeals Council, the District Court, and this court are sit in equal ability to assess the legal effect of testimony rendered. This court reviews the ALJ's findings for substantial evidence, but we review the legal sufficiency of a decision de novo. The claimant... in this case, Mr. Rincon, the claimant in any case is entitled to have this court tell not only the claimant but the agency and the public that needs to have confidence in the system what the law says. And this court, beginning in Van Han versus Bowen, stated that the although the rulings do not have weight of law, they're not regulations, they're not part of the statute, they are entitled to Chevron deference. And unless they're plainly erroneous, this court defers to those rulings in its understanding of what the regulations mean. And when the regulation, as understood by the commissioner, tells us that the inability to stoop ordinarily is going to warrant the finding of a disability, once we've restricted the person to sedentary work, that understanding of the regulatory framework always has to be enforced.
Counselor, can I just shift our focus a little bit? I thought we were going to start off on the issue of Dr. Ross's opinion. As I've looked at this record, it looks like Dr. Petrigliano's testimony was viewed as more appropriate, more credible, and contradictory to Dr. Ross's. It seemed to me the ALJ did a rather thorough job of indicating why the one opinion overrode the other, why Dr. Ross's opinion was not entitled to basically carry the day. Isn't that all that the ALJ is required to do in this situation?
Well, the ALJ read Dr. Petrigliano's opinion as not requiring a cane, and eventually said that her opinion was consistent with Dr. Petrigliano's, but the consultative examiner clearly stated that Mr. Rincon could not engage in stooping because he needs a cane, and that's on page 379 of the record.
Which doctor was that?
That's the board eligible orthopedic surgeon that did the consultative examiner at the request of the state agency.
You don't remember his name? You don't remember his name?
Petrigliano. Oh,
Petrigliano.
Yeah, Petrigliano. That's the doctor that Judge Smith was just mentioning.
But basically, Dr. Petrigliano, his views conflicted with Ross's in several ways, and the ALJ took those views and went through Dr. Ross's testimony and used Dr. Petrigliano's views to say, I don't agree with Ross on this, I don't agree with Ross on that. This is what I'm relying upon, is this contrary physician's view. That's all the regs require, isn't it?
Legitimacy requires viewing them in context. Dr. Petrigliano said that...
You're talking about the weight. I'm talking about substantial evidence.
Right.
Petrigliano gave substantial evidence, right?
Yes.
Okay, so then the question is, the ALJ says, okay, Dr. Ross gave this testimony, Dr. Petrigliano gave something else, they each had substantial evidence. The ALJ, I'm going to look at this. I view Dr. Petrigliano's testimony and the evidence that he provided as being more persuasive to me for the reasons indicated over Dr. Ross's. That's all the system requires, isn't it?
The reasons that the ALJ articulated were that the weight of the evidence, the longitudinal view of the record.
Well, that was one of them. That wasn't the only one.
And that isn't a very good reason once we're talking about the difference between 1 hour and 2 hours a day. It just isn't substantial.
I thought Dr. Ross was a treating physician.
He is. And so his opinion is entitled to more weight.
Right. What his letter was August 13th, 07? Is that right? At least that's what it's dated.
He has one in 08. He did write a letter in 07. He also wrote or signed off on a medical source statement in 07, 08.
That's the questionnaire?
Yes.
And that, when did he do that?
The questionnaire.
I couldn't.
Is at.
Oh, I see. 229-08 is when he signs that questionnaire.
Correct. That's at page 350. He signs it on page 354 of the record in 08.
So how long had he. When he did the 07 letter, how long had Rincon been treating with him?
I don't think the record is clear on that. He had a gap between treatment in 05 and 07. It looks like he picks up in 07 with Dr. Ross, and he's with him until at least 2008 when Dr. Ross renders the second opinion. And Dr. Ross describes the condition as progressive atrophy of the extremity related to the gunshot wound.
From the letter, you can't really tell how long he's been treating this August 13th, 07 letter.
Well, the ALJ found that Mr. Rincon started treating in 07, and there's no evidence to the contrary for that. And so that I think I'm stuck with that finding, regardless of when something else may show. So I think the court should assume that he starts in 07, and by the time he fills out the medical source statement in 2008 that he's has about a year of treatment history with Mr. Rincon when he expresses the opinion that it's 1 hour of standing and walking, no stooping.
He had some treatment between 2008 and 2011, but it wasn't by Dr. Ross, right?
Correct. It was by other physicians. There's one record that says he doesn't have atrophy. Most of the records there are references to having a severely antalgic or antalgic gait, that he doesn't flex his knee when he just swings his leg around. He's not walking in a normal, he's got a trendable gait. He's got a lot of abnormalities that are reflected in the treatment records.
But it's not absolutely clear that he couldn't stoop or he couldn't stand. It's not as if it was as clear as it was to Dr. Ross. In that interim period of time from 2008 and 2011, whatever records that are there, that would support Dr. Ross as opposed to Dr. Pigliano.
Well, the only inference that flows from the evidence that we have in the record is that we have a progressively deteriorating condition. When he's released from surgery in 2005, the doctors are projecting that he's going to be able to ambulate and walk in a relatively normal fashion post-gunshot wound. By the time we get to 07 and 08, when he's treating with Dr. Ross, Dr. Ross is describing a precipitous decline in his functioning, and the subsequent records show that his gait never improved. There is one reference to the contrary, but in general, his gait never improved, and the muscle atrophy never recovers. He's losing muscle mass, and his gait is getting worse. And that's exactly what Dr. Ross described in 2008, and Dr. Petrigliano said, it's not dark gray, it's only medium gray. It's a shade of gray apart.
Can I get just one clarification about the record?
Yes.
On the mental health part of his claim?
Yes.
Apparently this was sent back down by the appeals council to further develop the record, I guess. I'm not sure exactly why they sent it back down, but they asked the ALJ to take a further look at the mental health issues. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, so then there were no further examinations that were done when it came back down. Right. And instead, they had the expert testify at the hearing.
Dr. Peterson, right. Yes.
Now, there's some reference in the documentation to a Dr. Cochlin?
Yes.
Cochlin? With whom he apparently had been treating. Is that right?
He saw a number of doctors at LA County Mental Health and Exodus, and I believe that's one of the doctors that's treating him.
From what I could tell, after the ALJ's decision in this case,
yes.
You sent some records regarding Dr. Cochlin to the Appeals Council. Is that right?
I believe I did, Your Honor.
So those records were not before the ALJ because the ALJ makes a statement that there's no evidence of ongoing one-on-one treatment.
Right.
And Dr. Cotlin's records seem to indicate that there had been one-on-one treatment for a period of time prior to the hearing.
That he did, in fact, have some treatment.
Right. Yes. And at the hearing, he testifies that he was getting some treatment.
That's correct.
But his testimony was discredited, I gather.
Primarily because we didn't have the records. They weren't before the ALJ. They weren't there for Dr. Peterson to review. And Dr. Peterson was relying on a pretty sparse record of treatment, which this court in Wynn versus Chater has recognized is not surprising.
Now, prior to the hearing, there is some reference to Dr. Cotlin in the... I guess it's the records from the Harbor Medical, UCLA Harbor Medical Facility.
Yeah.
I believe there's in one of the, it's with the mental, it's with the social worker. In any event, it notes that he's seen Dr. Cotlin.
One of the records refers to it as Cotkin.
Cotkin, I'm
Cotkin.
Sorry.
Cotkin. And those records were available to Dr. Ritvo, and he references them at page 518 of the record in expressing
his
opinion.
Did anybody explore what the extent of his consultations with Dr. Cotkin were?
Was not explored, Your Honor.
You didn't do that? After the Appeals Council sent it back down for that very purpose, to clarify what his mental health status was?
I know that there were... records that were obtained and submitted.
Well, we know after the fact that he was seeing Dr. Cotkin.
Correct. There were records from Harbor UCLA that were presented before the hearing, and those. But it's just two pages. That's all we were able to get that was presented to the ALJ. You know, we request records. The subpoenas are very difficult to get from the agency. It's just... We do the best we can, and we present the records.
Nobody asked him at the hearing who he had. He testified that he was seeing somebody.
Correct.
Nobody asked him, who are you seeing? How many times do you see him? What day do you see him? You see him once a week, twice a week, every other week, once a month? Nobody asked him any questions like that. Anyway, we'll hear from the government.
That's it. Thank you.
Good morning, Shea Bond, on behalf of the government, Commissioner of Social Security. I would like to respond first to the argument made regarding Dr. Ross. I believe Your Honor had a question about the level of treatment, I think, that Dr. Ross had provided.
Yes.
At the time of, I guess, the first letter.
Yes.
If you look at this is Exhibit B2F of the administrative record. I believe it starts on page 358, and it goes on for several pages. That lists Dr. Ross's treatment records. If you look at the last page of that exhibit, it's 369. You have a date of December 2006, and then the next date is June of 2007. So at the time that Dr. Ross had written the first letter, it appears that there had been maybe two visits. And then I think the total amount of treatment visits with Dr. Ross over this two-year period, I guess, was about 7 visits. So, but when you look at Dr. Ross's treatment records, they're very sparse when it comes to, in terms of objective findings. When the claimant came in and complained of, I think he complained of neck pain a few times and then knee pain maybe once or twice. The objective findings are just very limited. Dr. Ross says that the claimant is in no acute distress. There's really no testing of like ranges of motion. He did notice that there was some tenderness in the neck, some crepitus in the knee, but there's nothing that justifies the level of limitation that's described in that first 2007 letter and then the questionnaire that came out in March of 2008. There's just the level of limitation.
He did examine him, apparently, correct?
Well, yes, presumably he examined him.
I mean, why isn't he able to draw some conclusions from his examination?
Well, the doctor can draw conclusions, but when we're looking at opinions regarding functional limitation, the commissioner's regulations say they have to be justified by objective findings. And so the objective findings we have here are going to be the contemporaneous treatment records that...
Well, but this was... So we know for a fact that he had, you know, the gunshot wound.
Correct.
And he had some serious surgery, and he had metal. He had rods in his leg.
Correct, to correct the fracture.
And he was still having problems.
Yes, he came in and he complained.
Nobody really seems to dispute that.
Well, no, and neither did the ALJ. I mean, when you look at the RFC finding, it's very restrictive. It's a sedentary with stand and walk and sitting. He's able to use, or he's required or allowed to use his cane. We have lots of limitations on postural movements. So, yes, the ALJ absolutely believed that this was a significant limiting impairment. But when we're turning to the question of the legitimacy of Dr. Ross's opinion, which had much more restrictive limitations, and I do disagree with counsel that Dr. Ross's opinion is almost identical to Dr. I believe it's Petrileone, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. There's the 1 hour versus 2 hours of standing and walking, and then there's also the 1 hour that Dr. Ross assessed for sitting as opposed to the 6 hours that Dr. Petrileone found. So there's actually really is quite a difference between those two opinions. But again, getting back to the legitimacy of Dr. Ross's opinion, we have to look to see what objectives would have supported the extra limitations. And so we go and we do look at the contemporaneous treatment records, and a doctor will typically write down the types of limitations they would see on a clinical examination in those records. Now, given the limited number of times that Dr. Ross had actually examined the claimant, you would think that the doctor would record any kind of extreme limitations like the limitations in this significant muscle atrophy or the significant ranges of motion limitations that he describes later on in his letter and in the questionnaire. They simply just do not appear in those contemporaneous treatment records. And that is what the ALJ identified as one of the reasons for finding that Dr. Ross's opinion should be afforded less weight than, say, Dr. Petrileone, who had the very detailed clinical findings during his examination. And I would also point out that the ALJ also afforded weight to our state agency reviewing physician who had looked at the evidence for the physical impairments. That was Dr. I think it's Husey or Hukey. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but that's on page 42 of the administrative record where the ALJ is saying that our state agency doctor also confirmed Dr. Petrileone's opinion and examination and the types of limitations the claimant would have.
Between 2008 and 2011, he didn't see Dr. Ross or Dr. Petrileone. And so does the evidence that was there for that period of time support one position or another?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the last part?
Which of the doctors does it support if it supports either of them?
Well, it doesn't support Dr. Ross's opinion because, again, the later treatment records, we do have the claimant coming into and complaining of certain pain or problems that he's having. But again, when you look at the objective findings, the clinical findings that were recorded contemporaneously, they just don't rise to the level of supporting Dr. Ross's opinion. It would support Dr. Petrolioni and what our state agency's view of that record would have been.
As I understand it, the records show that he received pain medication. That was basically it in terms of treatment.
Correct. I would also just wanted to touch on what Mr. Rolfing was talking about with the Social Security rulings and the vocational expert's testimony. I think Mr. Rolfing is misunderstanding the Social Security rulings in this case. They don't mandate specific findings. The ones that were in play in this case, which is 96-9P, 83-12, and 83-14, they all say that when a residual functional capacity either falls between two exertional levels or there are additional non-exertional limitations, which we had here, like the use of the cane or limitations on balancing, they direct the ALJ to obtain vocational expert testimony because there is an open-ended question about what kind of limits these RFC limitations are going to have on the occupational base. And so the ALJ did exactly what she was supposed to do here, which was to consult with a vocational expert who then explained, yes, there are jobs that this particular claim can do within this residual functional capacity. And if there are no further questions.
What about Dr. Kocken?
Those
records
the later records.
The later records, they go to the appeals council, right?
You're talking about after the first.
No, after the second hearing.
After the second hearing. I see what you're saying. Yes. And so what the impact of those records would have
been.
But
we know from after the fact that he was seeing somebody on a regular basis.
For mental impairment.
For his psychosis.
Yes, and you know he had sought treatment prior. It was very minimal.
One of the things, though, that the ALJ noted was that he had not been receiving one-on-one treatment.
Well, the ALJ,
which Dr. Peterson testified to at the hearing,
was
the way in which you would deal with his problem is you would go one-on-one with a psychiatrist or a psychologist.
Correct. And when the medical expert was reviewing the record, which is what the appeals counsel had instructed to do on remand, was to take a look at this additional evidence, call a medical expert to give an opinion, and that's exactly what the medical expert did here. And so that medical expert, after reviewing the records...
But he didn't have Dr. Cotton's records.
No. If it was the later submitted to the appeals counsel, right. Then no. But... there's a level of consistency here in the record overall, where we had during the relevant period we had four doctors, two were examining doctors, two were reviewing, one being the medical expert and one being our state agency doctor, who, after examining the claimant and reviewing what they had, determined that the claimant had either no or mild mental limitations. So that was very consistent throughout the record. The additional records that were submitted to the appeals council would not have changed that.
Well,
outcome.
We don't know, though. We don't know what Dr. Cochran might have said if somebody had contacted her to get her records, or him to get his records, whoever it was.
Well, it's plaintiff's burden ultimately to prove their disability claim.
Well, isn't it also the ALJ's burden to develop the record?
Well, the ALJ was following
the appeals
counsel.
Testified at the hearing. Nobody asked him. When he testified at the hearing that he was seeing a psychiatrist one-on-one.
You mean the claimant?
The claimant. Nobody asked him, who are you seeing?
And claimant had counsel at the hearing who absolutely could have asked those questions if counsel and plaintiff thought that was relevant to the application.
But you're right.
That's not the government's responsibility, is it, to develop the record in that manner? Isn't that the claimant's responsibility,
well,
if at all?
Again, absolutely. It is ultimately the claimant's burden to support their application for disability. Obviously, this claim had been remanded, as it were, by the appeals counsel for specific consideration of this mental impairment issue. Therefore, counsel and the claimant were aware that this was at issue and absolutely could have fully developed that at the record.
Well, but the case law and the regulations also provide that even if they're represented by counsel, the ALJ has an obligation to fully develop the record.
What does that mean?
And I would submit, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What does that mean in response to my colleague's view? What does that mean if the ALJ has the responsibility to develop the record? What does that mean in practical terms?
Well, in terms of what the circuit law says, it's if the record is ambiguous. And here we don't really have an ambiguous record that was before the ALJ at that time. We had a record, again, that had four medical opinions that assessed the claimant with no to mild limitations. There was very little in terms of treatment for the mental impairment. We had the ALJ was specifically following the instructions from the Appeals Council to have the medical expert review this record. And ultimately, the claimant was represented by an attorney at the hearing who could have developed this record as well. There was basically nothing else for this ALJ to do based on this record. It was not an ambiguous
well,
record.
Well, Dr. Peterson's testimony is less than clear.
I'm sorry, could you repeat
that? Dr. Peterson's testimony is less than clear.
Well, Dr. Peterson was saying that based on the record that was before him, this was the best conclusion he could come up with because there were inconsistencies. The claimant had presented at one of the consultative examinations, at both consultative examinations being very vague and evasive. The one consultative examiner who had the more thorough narrative report was explaining that he was actually exaggerating his condition, and it was really suspected that he was doing it in order to get disability benefits from the government. That was Dr. Sherrill. She drew that conclusion. So, when the agency sends the claimant for multiple consultative examinations and has our state agency doctors reviewing the record, that is how the agency attempts to develop the record. Ultimately, if the claimant had additional records to submit, the claimant through counsel should have submitted that to the agency at the appropriate time.
Let me ask you a question about the vocational expert and what she relied on. Counsel has said that the information that she had to establish that he could do sedentary work was not enough or was inaccurate, and there was a colloquy between counsel and the vocational expert about the browser that was used. And, I'm frankly unclear as to what she was doing relying on and what counsel was relying on in order to establish that it was reliable and for counsel to try to establish that it was unreliable. So what in the record will establish that, in fact, these jobs were available? It seems kind of interesting to me that the vocational expert can come up with 2,000 stone setters and 70,000, or locally, that would be in L.A., 70,000 nationally at the time. So that's pretty dramatic in my point of view. And this was challenged. So why is the record clear from your point of view that, in fact, the vocational expert was correct?
Well, I think the record is clear because the question that Mr. Rolfing was asking, the numbers that Mr. Rolfing was presenting at the hearing, ostensibly off the Job Browser Pro software, the vocational expert kept explaining to him that he was looking at the wrong numbers. So she said, those numbers that you're talking about represent categories of occupations, not the jobs within each occupation that she identified. So say, taking, for example, a stone setter position, she was identifying 2,000 jobs within a particular category of job. And so when Mr. Rolfing kept saying, well, I'm showing you the software, and this says, whatever numbers he was coming up with, there are no occupations within the state of California, there are only seven nationally. I know those aren't the exact numbers, but just for an example. And she said, well, you're looking at categories of employment, not job numbers. So she was trying to redirect him to saying, this is what I'm identifying. And under the case law of the circuit, under Bayless, it's the vocational expert's own expertise that is the foundation for the basis of identifying the job numbers. Now, I would liken...
What was she relying on, though? I'm very curious as to how she came up with this by her particular browser versus something else.
Well, she never testified at the hearing that she actually used Job Browser Pro. When Mr. Rolfing posed the question to say, do you use Job Browser Pro in your practice in general, she said yes, but she never said that she used Job
what
Browser
did she,
Pro for
what did
this
she
specific.
Say she used in
it's
order to
be,
come up?
It's going to be her own, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
That's okay,
but it
go
was going to be her own experience. The fact that she said she observed later on in the testimony, she talks about, well, I've observed, like, bench assembly jobs. Like, that's what she does. And that's what the vocational expert's testimony is based upon, their qualifications, their experience.
That's true, except that she got very specific. A stone setter.
Correct.
An account, you know, somebody who does some kind of a review accounting expertise. But I don't know that anywhere in the record how she came up with that.
Well, under Bayless, the controlling circuit precedent, she doesn't have to. It's the challenge in Bayless was that the plaintiff said, well, we don't know how the vocational expert came up with these numbers because it wasn't identified at the hearing. And this court in Bayless said that's not required. It's a fact that the vocational expert is recognized as an expert in this area, and it's just the experience and the expertise that is sufficient to
identify. Which was never challenged.
Jobs. Correct. And the questioning that Mr. Rolfing presented on Job Browser Pro was asking the wrong question. It was focusing on the wrong job numbers. He was looking at categories of occupations, not the actual job numbers within those particular occupations.
Thank you, Ms. Bond.
Thank you very much. We ask that you affirm.
I'm not sure that you had any time left, Mr.
Rolfing. I don't think I did. I don't.
I don't know that I have anything else to add.
We appreciate your arguments. Matter submitted.